I wish I contributed. I wish I saved more. I wish I spent less money on dumb things. So much of looking back in the rearview mirror of our life is we don't regret the things that we did that went poorly. We often regret what we didn't do. And a lot of people are regretting not saving that money.
I'll do it tomorrow, or I'll start this next week, and then that continues into next year, and then you kind of forget about it. It's better to do something and do the not optimal thing than nothing at all, right?
What is up, everybody? And welcome back to the Schooling Struggle Podcast. It is our belief that the only guarantee in life is that we are all going to struggle, and how we choose to embrace our struggles is what empowers us to become the best versions of ourselves. How is it going? My name is Pete, coming to you from Heartland, Vermont. And with me is our monthly contributor, Mr. Doug Anton. What's up, Doug?
Hey, Pete. How's it going?
Gosh, over a year ago when you made your first appearance on the show, we started to dabble and talk a little bit about finances. In line with the theme of our show, Schooling Struggle, I think one topic that is really worth diving into, even though it might not be the most exciting or sexy topic out there, is navigating the challenges of finances. I know many people in my orbit and many people all over the world really struggle with the challenges of saving money, how to spend money, the costs and the rising costs and the inflation of everything. So I just want to give the listeners a heads up that this might not be the sexiest topic that we've dove into over the course of our 93 episodes on the Schooling Struggle podcast, but I think it is one worth really taking some time to spend, to focus on, so that we can strive to be better versions of ourselves in the arena of the best ways that we can be prudent with our money. And you mentioned a flow chart that we very lightly touched upon. So for months, I've been asking Doug to come back on and talk about the flow chart. That's how I'm going to refer to it. And it's basically, if we are going to be financially literate, how we go about that. One thing that I love about our family listeners is truly how it's a makeup of all ages. So Doug, just to give you a little bit of background, about one third of our listeners are under the age of 25. About one third of our listeners are between the ages of 25 and 45. And then one third of our listeners are 45 plus. And it's a big ask for me to ask Doug to frame this conversation in a way that's going to hit all three of those groups. But I'm confident that he can do that because he's a master. And I know the type of preparation he puts into getting ready for these shows. And I'm just super excited to make this very digestible and understandable. It's a big challenge I have for you, Doug, but I'm super psyched to have you on because I know this is a passion of yours. You teach economics classes at our school, and in your personal life, you love to delve and dive into this stuff. And whenever I have questions about finances, are you the first person I go to? So I thought you'd be an awesome resource to have this conversation with me tonight for the benefit of our listeners.
For sure. Thanks for having me on again. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about these kind of topics. This one especially is an area where we can get a bit more concrete and more detail oriented. I know that I have a penchant for the abstract and the big picture, which is not always concrete and tangible. So I'm excited to get into like the nitty gritty and give people some real takeaway advice tonight.
Awesome. And just a disclaimer that Doug is not a, what's the term? A certified registered financial advisor.
Exactly right. I'm not a tax attorney. I'm not a certified financial planner. I'm not an investment advisor. Certainly can't make purchases for anyone, but I think we can talk in generalities and we can certainly talk about what we do as a vehicle for kind of providing some examples and hypotheticals about what people might want to consider.
I don't want the young listeners out there to be scared away by the introduction of this and turn off the pod, because the way that we're going to talk about this is real basic terms that anyone can understand. Think of like finances 101. However, for those of you who are already invested in your financial future, I think you're still going to have some takeaways from this episode. So with that said, let's dive right into it, Doug.
Yeah, let's do it. So you referenced the flow chart, and I know you'll put this in the show notes. We're going to start with kind of the level one, the kind of the ground floor of personal financial well-being. We really should call it kind of section zero, which the flow chart refers to as kind of budget and the essentials. So the first step is to create a budget. You really need to do that before you do anything else, because a budget is an instrument for keeping track of expenses, money going out, and income, money coming in. And too often people like to focus on the income side of things, right? I know I check my bank account every other Friday just see that paycheck landed in there. But the expenses side is arguably even more important than the income side, because we need to see what things we're spending our money on. Pete, can you tell me a little bit, because I actually don't know the answer to this, how or what your personal kind of budget looks like? What method, or what is it, an app? Is it a spreadsheet? Is it a pen and pencil? What do you use?
Yeah, so I'm a complete nerd about this. I love this. I've explained to my brother how I do this. My brother says, that sounds horrible to me. And I think what's interesting much about like coaching fitness is everyone's motivated differently and everyone approaches it differently. So just because this works for me, I'm not saying this works for everybody. But the first month that my wife and I were married, we just decided to just keep track of everything that we spent money on. So we kept receipts of everything. If we had cash purchases, we just kind of kept a ledger of that. So we had a basic idea of what a month of our life together would look like. So that was the first step for us, was creating a budget, like how much do we spend on everything, lock, stock, and bang every month. And then what my wife was raised doing, and I had never done this before we got together, I just made sure prior to marrying her that I always made more than I spent. It was just important to spend less than I made, which sounds simple, but is challenging in some ways. And what her family did growing up was they had categories, they had buckets of where they spent money. Think of like columns. And to answer your question, we just did it as just pen and paper on a line sheet and just made columns. And the columns that we had were kind of the set expenses, the rent at the time when we were renting, our car payments, student loans, cell phone bills, those things that didn't change much from month to month. And then there was the stuff that we spent money on. So our big buckets are food, entertainment, gifts for each other and for other people, miscellaneous, which is like toiletries and items that you might buy at the grocery store that are not actual food items, gasoline. We have one or two others, travel and medical. And then when our daughter is born, we create a couple different categories for her. She has activities that she does, such as gymnastics, but there's also clothes and items, that essential items for her. I really nerd out on this and I really, really look forward to this. But at the end of every month, I sit down, it takes me about an hour and a half, and I comb through all of our expenses and then I put them in the buckets. And then we budget out per month how much we're going to be spending in each of those buckets. Then we just try to stick to those numbers. And now that we've been doing it for 12 years, it's pretty seamless.
So it sounds like you take a pretty detailed approach and also a pretty kind of consistent approach where you've done this long enough now where it's become ingrained as a habit. And so I think that's one of the most important things about a budget, is that by seeing these numbers and seeing these categories or buckets, as you say, it really gives you a perspective on, oh, wow, that's how much this costs, or every month that much is being spent on what. And that can help you develop a consistent habit of, okay, I know gasoline generally is going to cost about this much, but I really spending a lot more on takeout than I realized. Or if I add up all my streaming services, I'm spending $250 a month just on that. And then you multiply that per year, you know, that's $3,000 that I could be spending on something else. So I'm glad to hear that. Personally, I take a much more lenient approach. Because my wife and I use pretty much only our credit card to pay for everything. I don't keep a ledger or anything handwritten or anything like that. But I just use some of those tracking apps, including like the bank app that I have one of my credit cards through, that basically will automatically categorize all purchases I make. And every month I can say, okay, I spent X number of dollars total, and 12% of that was on dining out, and 30% was on groceries, and 15% was at retail. And then, you know, I kind of can put little flags or little notifications, you know, kind of let me know, send me a notification if 1 month or 1 week I'm kind of on track to spend a lot more than usual. I find that helpful as a bit of a guideline, but nothing that I have to necessarily stick hard and fast to. The thing I find most helpful is I have a kind of a master spreadsheet that's kind of the big picture stuff. So less of the, you know, I'm not necessarily planning out how much I'm going to spend on toilet paper and shampoo in a month, but I'm just saying an average, my credit card is built in total for toilet paper and clothes and groceries and eating out a couple times and Netflix and all those things added up is generally around this amount. And then I round up a little bit and then I say, here's how much we're going to put in our college account for one of our daughters. Here's how much for the other account. Here's how much in retirement. And then that's balanced by our income coming in. And the final number that kind of spits out is about how much money will be in our bank account. If we continue to make this much money and we continue to spend this much money, 3 months from now, I'll have X number of dollars in my bank account. 5 years from now, I'll have X number of dollars. And that lets me say, okay, I see that we're on track with a huge surplus. We can increase our retirement, or I'm going to go ahead and add around the holidays an extra $1,000 or whatever for expenses for gifts and travel. and those things that, you know, maybe come up seasonally. So that lets me see the big picture. But one area where I know I could do even better is looking at that day-to-day or the week-to-week spending.
The listeners of the show have heard me say this many times, but for me personally, discipline is freedom. So knowing that I can spend my money however I want, as long as I'm sticking within those kind of monthly sets that we have, is really, really comforting for me. So I'm never worried, because it's like, all right, we're going to spend X amount of dollars on food every month. As long as I'm below that, I'm good to go. And I don't end up worrying about it. And I also am very goal oriented. So if I know that this is the amount that I'm going to spend on food this month, like, the goal is to come in under that, and not like grossly under that. Not like, you know, if the goal is $100 to be coming in at $20, the goal is to be coming in around $90 or $95, those types of things. And that really helps motivate me.
It's a nice element of finances that isn't necessarily present with some of the other kind of life improvement areas that people often undertake. We've got numbers. We've got nice, concrete, and clear goals. So if, you know, my goal is to save X number of dollars or to make X number of dollars in a month, that's really concrete and tangible versus more generally lose weight, eat healthier, sleep more, be happier, et cetera.
Yep. So step number one is to get an idea of what you're currently spending money on. So once you know that, then you can move to the next piece, which is...
The second step here in the flowchart is to take into account your housing costs. So for some of our listeners, that's going to be nothing because you're still in high school, or maybe you're in college and you're living at home, or whatever the situation is. But for many people, right, that's either our rent or our mortgage. That kind of needs to come first, because, you know, housing and accommodation is one of those needs before we can pay for Netflix or dine out or even save money for retirement. We need to make sure that we're meeting our obligations in that regards. This is, I would say, especially true of mortgage payments, because if you don't pay your rent long enough, yep, you can get evicted. And of course, there's consequences, and it's financially and psychologically and in many ways damaging. But of course, missing out your mortgage payments for long enough and getting your house foreclosed on, you're then losing all that investment, all that money, all that time you put into it. It's hugely devastating. So we want to take care of that second.
Awesome. And you did mention that I'll be dropping the link for this flowchart in the show notes. For the listeners, you're always welcome to scroll down the show notes, click on this link, and then that will bring you to exactly what we're talking about.
The next step after our mortgage and our rent, our housing is taken care of, is, of course, food and groceries. This is one of those things where there's, I think, a lot of money to be cut when times are tough. I don't know about you, Pete. I know you spend a lot on really healthy and nutritiously dense food. My family's grocery bill is about $200 to $225 per week. I consider myself fairly frugal in about half the spending I do, right? We're buying the Hannaford brand cereal, and we're buying the big bag of rice and pasta. But the other half stuff is, you know, we are paying for the fresh fruit with you know, I'm not necessarily getting the cheapest apples. I'm getting the kind that I like the most. I'm getting a couple Ben and Jerry's. Maybe I shouldn't tell you that. But, you know, for those who are just trying to take stock of their whole financial situation, kind of looking at how much you're spending on food, on groceries per week, and really, you know, committing to the basics at first as you build up your financial situation is important.
Yeah, I think that's huge. I think of all the ways that we can save money, the food place is a way that we can do that. And I truly believe that we can eat nutritiously dense and eat healthy and not break our budget. One place to start is just cutting back on prepared foods. So any fast food, any restaurants, any gas station food, anything that is quick and easy often costs a lot more money because somebody had to prepare that for you and you're paying for that. So I've shared on this podcast many times that my wife and I rarely, if ever, go out to eat, because a night for the three of us out, one dinner, is approximately 25% of an entire week's worth of groceries for us. So that's just a place where I don't find value spending money, whereas other people love to go out to eat, and they should. I'd rather spend that money on workout equipment, but I realize I'm in a real minority of people. But I think just taking a hard look at not only your grocery bills, but what are you spending on food across the board? That quick trip to the gas station to get a $6 snack, and that coffee every morning, and all those different things really add up. And that's a place where at least I've found that I can save and put towards something that's more important to me than a number two at McDonald's.
Another way that I kind of accomplished that goal while shopping is using the unit price. I know most people are probably familiar with the concept of, like, okay, so I'm looking at five different kind of cuts of chicken or different brands of chicken or whatever, and I can look right there in front of me. Okay, you know, this one's $4 per pound, but the one that's, you know, already, you know, deboned and deskinned and it has a little seasoning on it, well, that's $9 a pound, even though it's both chicken breasts. that's obviously helpful. But I think even beyond just that, more conceptually, as you explore and you work your way around the store, look at in general what unit pricing generally things cost. So the fact that, wow, look how many bananas I can get or apples I can get for $5 or $10 for that same amount of money, I'm getting way less of the cookies or the crackers or the chips or something like that. Seeing that some things per pound, when I'm even, you know, it can even be some healthy options. Little dried mango snack my daughter was asking for the other day at the store. And I was showing her, this is like, it was $32 per pound. It was like a half, you know, a half pound bag was, you know, in the teens. And it was, you know, to think that we can get 30 times as much of the fresh stuff for the same price was pretty shocking.
Yeah, I refer to that unit pricing to my students as the orange sticker. So when you're at the grocery store, check out the orange sticker, and the orange sticker will give you exactly what Doug's talking about, the unit pricing.
After we've got our food and our groceries taken care of here, the next step in the chart is to pay your essential items. So of course, that's always kind of somewhat up to you about what counts as essential. But generally, we're talking about things like utilities, right? So you got to make sure you got your power, your heat, your water bill, toiletries, you need toothpaste and toilet paper and things like that. I challenge you I challenge listeners to think about essential as really that essential. I know that many of us have maybe become accustomed to, well, yeah, my iPhone is essential. Well, maybe having a phone is essential, but it doesn't need to be a $1,500 newest model, right? My phone plan is essential, sure, but does it need to be the unlimited with, you know, add-ons and all the other kind of stuff? So pay those essential items next, before moving on to those expenses that you need to make a living. So if you need to drive to work, you need a car, or at least a bike, or, you know, a friend with a car. Exactly. I mean, in the Upper Valley, right? You don't even need that. For many people, right, that might mean internet and phone connections, right? If you're working from home, or if you're working remotely or digitally, or if part of your work involves a computer and online, those expenses are justified because you need those things to make money. Moving up a little bit, this is where things start to get a bit trickier, right? The next step on the on the flowchart is to pay your healthcare and your healthcare related costs. Health insurance is obviously extremely important for your own health and safety. Things can happen to anybody, no matter how cautious you are, and you want to make sure that you're covered and you're taken care of. So any sort of health insurance premiums or the healthcare related expenses that come up, we've got to pay those, and we should be paying those before we get to those next level of things like saving for retirement and investing and things like that.
After I graduated college, I just became a snowboard bum for a bunch of years, and I quickly learned that health insurance is the improper usage of the term. It's financial insurance, because if I crashed on my snowboard, I was going to go to the hospital, I was going to get care, I was going to be cared for, but it was going to have an immense financial cost. So yes, it's known as healthcare and health insurance, but it's actually, in a way, a high level of financial insurance. Because if you get stuck with a hefty medical bill, it can affect you for a long period of time.
Well said. I never thought about it that way, but that makes perfect sense.
Fortunately, you are taken care of if you show up at the ER, no matter what the ailment is or how much or little money you have. So that's good.
We're lucky to live in society where that is the case. But certainly beyond that, a basic level of keeping you alive, I'm not sure what kind of quality of care you're going to get, unfortunately, unless you have some sort of higher coverage insurance. So definitely want to make sure we take care of that next. Moving on up is to make the minimum payments on your debts. For some of you, that could look like a student loan payment. For many of you people, this is going to be a car payment. For others, this could be credit card debt. That could be a small amount, a large amount. But typically, when you get that bill, whether it's a credit card or a car statement or whatever, you'll see that your balance, you know, that's the actual amount you owe, you know, that monthly payment. They usually are breaking this up into monthly payments. But then they'll also have a number somewhere that says that minimum payment. We shouldn't confuse this, right? Paying the minimum payment doesn't mean that we're getting ahead of this debt, but it means that we're not getting really, really, really behind. Because if we don't pay that minimum payment, that's where all sorts of additional fees, late fees, additional interest rates kick in. This is where accounts can get sent to collections, where you're going to be getting nasty phone calls, or depending upon what the asset is that you haven't paid off, you may have people showing up at your house to repossess your car or something like that. So we want to make sure we're paying the absolute minimum payments. Ultimately, our goal, of course, is to work our way up and pay them off in full. But as we work our way up the chart here and kind of start from the highest priority and the necessities on up, we want to make sure we're making all those minimum payments.
So in college, the credit card companies are always set up on different places in campus trying to recruit you to get a credit card, because once they get you hooked at a really young age, it's really good for them. And oftentimes kids' parents will help bail them out. But this kid, he goes, yo, I got this awesome idea. I go, what? He goes, I'm going to go to that credit card table and get a credit card. I'm like, okay. He goes, and then I'm going to take all of you to a Yankees game. And then after that, we're going to go to the sweetest steakhouse in New York City. And it's going to be like the most expensive night ever, but I don't care. I'm just going to put all in their credit card and then never pay it off. And I was like, that sounds awesome for one night. But the reality is that will destroy your credit score, and that will prevent you from being able to make other purchases such as house, cars, other things in the future. And if you damage your credit score early or whenever, it's tough to come back from and tough to be given the opportunity to buy stuff at lower interest rates or to buy stuff, period. So just something to be aware of, that if you default or you don't make those minimum payments, that can have a negative impact on you for a lifetime.
And even outside of just future loans, a lot of people say something like, okay, well, even if my credit score is terrible, that's fine. I just won't get another credit card or whatever. Well, it's also going to affect your ability to buy a car or finance a car. It's going to affect your ability to buy a house and get a mortgage. And even things that aren't purchases, applying for rent an apartment, many landlords will require a credit check or a credit score to see kind of your financial history. Credit score, for better or for worse, is often used as kind of a way to numerically look at someone you don't know and judge if they're trustworthy or legitimate or not. And so that could be used against you in the future.
So let's say I've created my budget. I'm paying my rent. I got my food. I'm paying my utilities and my essential items. I have locked down what I need to get to and from work and access my job. I got healthcare. I'm making the minimum payments on all my debts. Then what, Doug?
So this is where I would say we move into that next level. So that is our essentials and our budget, money coming in and out, checked in. The next level is when we're ready to move up a little bit and start getting ahead and doing things a little bit more optimal and ideal. So that first step in that second level is to build a emergency fund. And we can keep this small. We don't need this to be thousands and thousands of dollars or enough money to live off of for years. But I think the best way to think about it is, $1,000 is a good goal. I would also use the concept of like 1 month's worth of expenses. So, rent for a month, plus a little bit of gas money, plus a little bit of food money, all those essentials that we just went over. Have that set aside, not in your bank account, not in cash underneath the mattress, not in cash in your freezer, but you want to put that in a high yield savings account. And the great thing about that is these are really easy to get access to. Many of them are online now. So, for example, I use a bank that doesn't even have branches. So I physically couldn't go to my bank if I wanted to. It's an app online, but I have it linked to, the bank, Mascoma Bank and other banks that I do have physical access to. And every month, I'm just putting a little bit away, adding to that emergency account and letting that build.
Credit card that I use for most of my purchases is an American Express. And through the account that I already had established through my card, they have a high yield savings account offer. So that's where I keep my high yield savings account, is with my credit card company.
That's perfect.
Yeah. Sometimes people ask me, how much should I keep in my checking account? And for me, I keep just a little bit more than I'm going to spend every month, because every penny that's not in that high yield savings account really isn't doing anything for me.
Exactly right. And so the high yield savings account, essentially, they're giving you higher interest rates. I think I get 4.5% or 5% on the one I use right now. Last month, through my different emergency funds and travel accounts, and I use it for a few different things, I think in total over the month, I got about $100 in interest. So that's kind of risk-free, FDIC guaranteed. It's not an investment. It's not the stock market. It's not betting and gambling on something. It's still a bank account, but they give you a higher interest rate. The only thing that's different from a savings or checkings account is that it's not a checkings account, so I can't write checks out of that account. I think usually it's harder to access that money with a debit card, but all I got to do is I can transfer that money. I can go on the app and I can say, hey, take $1,000 out of my emergency account because my car needs new tires, transfer that into my Mascoma savings bank, and 2 days later, it's there. So all you need is, with a little planning and heads up, you can access your money very easily and you get a much higher interest rate for it. So that's where you want to park your small emergency fund, with a goal of about 1 month's expenses or $1,000 if you like a concrete number to aim for.
Before hitting the record button, Doug said to me, hey, what's an example from your life where you had to access your emergency fund? And this winter, we had a bunch of family coming over for Christmas, and 2 days before Christmas, our boiler shut down. And if you live in Vermont... it's kind of an essential item. So having your house warm in the winter. So we had to pony up quite a bit of money for a brand new boiler and to have it paid to be installed and all that. And that came from our emergency fund.
The amount of things, you know, the examples you can come up with are nearly endless, right? A car repair, an injury, those things can kind of come out of nowhere. And moving on. Oh, sorry.
I was just going to say, quick advice to all high schoolers. Buying your boyfriend or girlfriend a pair of Jordan 9s for $450 is not emergency fund.
That's a great example, right? Let's keep the emergency. The focus should be an emergency, right? It's not take the fun out of fund and focus on the emergency. What's the most you've ever spent on shoes, Pete?
Not much. I don't spend a ton on shoes. My issue is I have lots of shoes, but I don't spend a lot per pair.
Okay, that's good. That's a topic for another day. But the American shoe companies have certainly won in the culture wars.
Yes.
Moving on from our small emergency fund, now that we've got that built up, we kind of want to take a quick kind of check in to revisit our expenses, right? Revisit our budget and look again at that concept of our essential versus non-essential expenditure. The easiest way to make more money is to spend less, right? A lot of times I see so many people, especially, you know, kids these days that are seeing things on TikTok and social media, you know, kind of the grind and entrepreneurial spirit things and how do we make all this money and live this lifestyle. And I love to see that they're motivated and driven and want to do better. But, you know, the famous saying, you know, a penny saved is a penny earned is really valid here. It's a lot easier for me to find $20 that I didn't need to spend this week than it is for me to be, you know, pick up a second job where I can go, you know, and go work an hour for $20. Maybe I should just forego, you know, the McDonald's on the way home or something. So we want to kind of review our budget and continue to keep track of our expenses. The next item on the flowchart here is fairly specific to some people. And so I'm going to touch on it very, very briefly. This is around the time where you want to start thinking about making investments and you want to start thinking about retirement. In general, the whole concept of this flowchart is found on the personal finance and financial independence subreddits, which are these forums online that are kind of communities of people that want to set themselves up for not only financial well-being, but even, again, getting ahead and kind of not just doing the rat race that many Americans do where you work for 30 or 40 years, you get to 65, and then you retire, live a modest retirement, and then you know, till the end of your life. But these people are trying to kind of get ahead and maybe retire early or have a very, very lucrative, you know, amount of money to spend in retirement, do the things they want to do. And one of the ways you can do that is by taking advantage of the matching contribution from your employer if they have one. I've had students, you know, as young as 16, 17, come to me and say, hey, I got this paper from my employer, not a big company, right? A local restaurant where they have a match. So if one of the employees contributes to their retirement account, the company matches that up to a certain percent. And there are very few things in life that are truly free, right? No such thing as a free lunch, but an employer retirement contribution match is free money. And you should always, always, always take advantage of that. So the next box here is to make sure that you're contributing enough to take a full advantage of that match.
So in layman's terms, if you don't know what a contribution match is, it's simply you take a dollar, you put it in this account, and your company will put the same amount that you put in up to a certain amount. Maybe, let's just say for easy math's sake, up to $100 a month. So if you were to put $100 a month into this account, your company would also put $100 a month. But if you put $101 in, the most they're going to do is $100 a month.
Exactly right.
And if you put zero into that account, they're going to put zero. So when Doug talks about free money, it's exactly what it is.
Right. And the reason they do this is because they want to incentivize saving, right? They want their employees to be well taken care of and be planning for the future. And so the fact that they're willing to do this, you know, it's not a match, like, you know, they're not going to pay you more money for working more or for working better or harder or anything like that. It's truly, if you are saving and investing in retirement vehicles, things typically called like a 401k account or a 403b account, if you're taking advantage of those, they'll give a little bit extra. So making sure you understand that. Sometimes it's a dollar amount, sometimes it's a percent, but ask your employer about that. In fact, that would be a good kind of, if you're taking notes at home, one thing to do, you know, tomorrow is ask your employer, is there a retirement contribution match? And if so, how much is it?
Cool.
After we got our retirement match, we've got that free money, we want to take care of that. The next thing is to then consider our debt. And I think it's important to note that even though we're already saving for retirement before fully tackling our debt, it's important that we're only doing that up until that employer match. We want that free money, but not a penny more. We don't want to be spending a penny more of our money until we've taken care of our debt as well. So the next step here is to pay down all high interest debt and loans. And those things you really want to tackle as soon as you can. There's a few different schools of thought around kind of the best way to do that. When I say high interest loans, I'm thinking loans that have 15, 20, 25% interest. So this is often things like credit card bills that haven't gone unpaid. It can be things like car loans if you have maybe a poor credit score, or you bought a car at a young age when you didn't really have an established credit score. And so you got this high interest rate. Especially it can kind of snowball where you miss a few payments, they start charging you additional penalties, and then the balance that you owe grows. And so therefore you're being charged more and more in interest. It can really kind of go out of control. The best way to pay this off numerically is to take whichever debt is the highest interest and make your payments and pay off that loans. There are all kinds of psychological games here at play as well. So several people, let's say you just graduated from college and you have two loans. Let's say you have a federal subsidized loan, which is $1,000. I'm just making up hypothetical numbers. Only $1,000 at 7% interest. And then you have another loan that's unsubsidized. That's $500 loan at 10% interest. That 10% interest one is the highest interest loan. So even though it's a smaller amount of money, you owe a smaller amount, that high interest is something you're going to want to take care of. So it makes sense to pay that off the soonest. It can be tempting sometimes. Let's say you have two loans or three loans. It can sometimes be tempting to just like pay off the one with the least amount of balance remaining. So let's say I have a loan for $1,000, $5,000, and $10,000. It's kind of tempting to say, let me just pay off the $1,000 one because like then I'll be done with it. And while that is true and mentally and psychologically, that can be powerful, numerically and financially, if you really care most just about dollars and cents, what will save me the most amount of money? Which will I pay the least amount of interest on overall? Take whichever loan has the highest interest rate and start paying it down as aggressively.
Nice. Awesome. I think that piece of information is a huge takeaway for anyone, regardless of age, because many people have different loans with different rates, and to understand the power and where your payoff should be going, I think is super, super helpful. All right. So I'm starting to make payments on my debts. I got all that other stuff squared away that we talked about in kind of that first stage. Where do I go once I'm starting to pay down my debts?
I think once your high interest debts are paid off, then we can again kind of go back to the idea of how do I optimize? How do I get ahead? How do I plan for the future? There is, kind of a debate in the field about, is it best to invest, right? If I can get 6 or 7 or 8 or 9% by investing in the stock market, should I do that instead of paying off my middle of the road interest debt? Let's say I have a 7% interest rate on my car loan. Should I pay off my car loan or should I invest for retirement? And some of those questions don't have easy answers. It's kind of up to you. It's kind of a wash. It's kind of the nice thing about some of the financial decisions, where if you have two really close decisions and you're really not sure which is the optimal, it may not matter that much because they may be pretty close, if you know what I mean. But I would say that the next step here is to kind of take care of your health insurance plan and really kind of understand your options. Most employers give a menu of health insurance plans. Most Americans don't understand them. I don't understand them. And I've spent hours and hours and hours reading through them.
I do not understand ours at all.
And unfortunately, this is kind of the system we live in. There is, many jobs have a human resources department or person who can kind of be a resource. Very generally, I would give the following advice. There are some plans that have a higher monthly cost, right? When it comes to health insurance, you pay what's called a premium. That's kind of your monthly health insurance bill. You pay that no matter what. And then that's kind of buying you the coverage. Now, most plans have something what's called a deductible. And the deductible is the amount of money that a person pays out of pocket until their health insurance plan kicks in. So the plans do get a bit convoluted, but generally, if you are fairly healthy, if you don't have a lot of regular health insurance costs, you can try to get what's called a high deductible health care plan, which has a lower monthly cost, but your potential out-of-pocket exposure is higher. The flip side is if you know that you are someone who's going to have a lot of healthcare costs, for example, if you know that you're planning to have a baby this year, or if you are on diabetes, on managed care, and you have all these regular treatments and medications and things like that, you may be wanting to pay for a lower deductible healthcare plan. So it's going to cost you more regularly upfront in your monthly premiums, but you're going to get a higher level of coverage so that when you need to go in or need to make those expenses and pay those bills, the insurance will cover more or even all of those costs as you go. So that's a bit of a very general advice.
Yeah, that first one that you talked about, I always refer to that as make sure you look both ways before you cross the street insurance plan. That's the one that I was on for all those years out after college, and I was rolling the dice and snowboarding, was a really low monthly cost and just hoping that I didn't get hit by a truck crossing the street.
Unfortunately, much of insurance is gambling, right? Where we are trying to face the odds and kind of consider what is the likelihood of X happening to me and how much, you know, am I willing to pay now, you know, ahead of time, and how much am I willing to pay if X or Y does happen to me at that time?
Cool. So once we kind of navigate all the different options of insurance and we move past that, what do we have next?
The next few elements, this is kind of the middle, or we're getting pretty close to the top of the tree here, where the flowchart is going to branch out in many different directions. And so it's harder to speak in generalities here because the nice thing about the flowchart is it has all these if-then statements where you can kind of find yourself and say, okay, if I fit in this category, if I have access to that, if this sounds like me, then I go to this other box. So very generally, once we've got health insurance covered, we want to start saving and we want to contribute to our retirement accounts. We've already been doing that minimum. Right? We referenced that already, that we're going to contribute the minimum to take advantage of the matching contribution from our employer. But beyond that, we want to contribute more. And there are a few different vehicles to do this. I would say one of the most important is an IRA. IRA stands for an individual retirement account. Anyone over the age of 18 can open one. If you are under the age of 18, you can still open one. You just need an adult or someone over 18 to serve as the custodian of that account. An IRA can be opened online. It will take you 10 minutes to do the paperwork, and then you'll get approved in a couple of days. The nice thing about an IRA is that it is not tied to your employer. The IRA is something that you put money in through your bank account. You choose the schedule, so you could do it every time you get paid, every couple of weeks. You could do it once a month. You could do it not at all for most of the year, get to December and kind of review your finances and say, oh, hey, I have an extra $1,000 in the bank. I'm going to contribute that to my IRA. There is a limit on how much you can contribute each year. I believe for 2023, it was $6,500. And I believe for 2024, it's going to be 7,000. So it's actually increasing pretty significantly this year. And that money goes into an account. And there's two types. There's what's called a Roth IRA and a traditional IRA. And I'm sure another time we'll have to talk more in depth about kind of retirement investing specifically. But the quick summary for our purposes tonight is that a Roth IRA is an account where you contribute money to it now. You do not get any tax benefit currently. I don't save on this year's taxes. I have to pay taxes on all my income just as I normally would, and then I can contribute. But when I take that money out, when I withdraw that money that's grown, hopefully using the stock market in 20, 30, 40 years in my retirement, I don't pay any income taxes on that money in the future. The traditional IRA is just the opposite effect, where every dollar I save in a traditional IRA right now, I get to not pay taxes on that money right now. The government's giving me a little freebie. They say, hey, we see you're saving for retirement. That's a good thing. We want to encourage that. If you put $1,000 into your traditional IRA this year, we're going to deduct $1,000 from your taxes, and you don't have to pay taxes on $1,000 of your income this year. The flip side, of course, is in retirement, when you pull out that money, plus all the growth and the returns on the investments you gained, you do pay taxes then. A very general rule of thumb is that if you're making around $70,000 or less living by yourself, or if you're married and filing your taxes together, making around $116,000, you generally want to stick that in a traditional IRA so you can take full advantage of kind of the tax benefit right now, and you won't necessarily mind paying the taxes on it in the future. If you're making a bit more money than that, so if as an individual you're making kind of $73,000 to $138,000, or married $116,000 to $218,000, that's where a Roth IRA is really good. You're kind of giving up that tax benefit now, but that money's going to grow and grow and grow, and then you're going to get a significant tax benefit in the future.
I was so freaked out by this by talking about IRA and Roth IRA and not understanding and not, and I was just scared. And when I'm scared of something, I just avoid it. And what I learned is that it's actually pretty simple. I went online, found, I ended up using E-Trade. A lot of my friends use Fidelity. It sounds like the family and friends that I have that go to Fidelity.com and use their platforms are really, really happy with the service. I don't love E-Trade nearly as much as my friends that speak for Fidelity. And my dad's an investor and he does all his stuff on Fidelity. But anyway, all that to say, like, it was super easy for me to open a Roth IRA. And then I just started putting money in there. And it's really simple because you don't have to worry about tax stuff with a Roth IRA right now. I don't have to tell my accountant about it, nothing. And then when I take that money out later in my life, I'll be good to go. So we've really prioritized putting money in a Roth IRA. The goal is not to take any money out of that Roth IRA, but if something happened and your emergency fund was exceeded and you needed to access that money, you can take out what you've put in. You just can't take out any money that money has made. So you can't take out any of the interest. I have yet to do that. Fingers crossed, things are okay. My boiler is boiling, but that's just something to be aware of.
You can always take out your money. You just have to pay a little penalty. So you're right. You can always take out the contributions to a Roth IRA. But even if that money has doubled in the stock market in your investments, it's still your money and you can pull it out. You just pay a fee of about 10%, I think, as like an early withdrawal fee. You can avoid that by waiting until you're 57 and a half, I believe, is the magic number where the government kind of says, okay, now you're old enough to retire.
Perfect. All right. Yeah, we're running up against the clock here, but is there anything else beyond that that you think is a worthwhile information for our listeners to take away from this conversation?
I would say both specifically on the retirement piece, but also more generally on everything we've discussed, you're spot on in that it can be confusing, complicated, overwhelming. It can be sometimes easier to just say, I'll do it tomorrow or I'll start this next week. And then that kind of continues into next year and then you kind of forget about it. It's better to do something and do the not optimal thing than nothing at all, right? I'd say it's kind of the same thing of like, you know, diet and exercise. Maybe my push-up form isn't perfect, but it's better for me to do a couple push-ups in imperfect form than none at all. Generally, I think that's probably true. You're nodding. But
yeah, I am nodding about that. I'm also nodding at the fact that I was just talking to my students last week about complexity being the enemy of execution, right? If something is very complex for me, I'm often less interested or more scared to take that step. And how can I make it as simple as possible? And I know once you've done something, you look back, you're like, oh, that wasn't as bad as I thought. But I think that the saving money and this budgeting stuff can seem incredibly daunting. But if you just take small steps that work for you and keep it as simple as possible, I think it's a really, really good way to go.
Yeah, I think it's hard to go wrong, right? So let's say you're looking at this flowchart, even, you know, you stare at it for a week and then, you know, next week you're like, okay, Pete and Doug told me to open an IRA. I still don't know which one to do. Doing either of them is going to be better than doing nothing, right? And, you know, the nice thing about this is there are people out there to help. You know, if you're like kind of professional service and accountants, there are plenty of people in the Upper Valley even who offer that. You know, you pay for their time, either an hourly fee or you pay a percentage of your investments, but they'll kind of do a lot of stuff for you. And then there are people like me who kind of have a middle ground there where I'm not taking a percentage of anyone's investments or anything like that, but I'm willing to meet with people and work with them on their kind of answer their questions and help them set things up themselves and kind of navigate the, you know, how do I make these decisions? What information do I need?
Quick little anecdote about Doug. This past summer, my mower died and I bought that mower 12 years ago. And when I went to the store to buy the same mower, the updated version of the mower, it had literally doubled in price. And I could not believe how expensive the mower was. And I was like, all right, well, I'm going to have to buy this mower. And then I realized right next to it was a mower that was like twice the machine for not that much more money. So I texted Doug. I was like, hey, I have the option to buy this mower, but it's too expensive for me to just buy outright. So I'm going to have to finance it at this percentage, or I can buy this other mower at this percentage. You know, can you crunch the numbers for me and tell me what I should do? And he responds, don't buy either. Just find a cheaper mower. And I think that's really important, is we can get into the crux of all of these numbers and these interest rates and these finances and all these things. But a lot of it is just common sense decisions with how we're spending our money. And I try to remind myself to keep coming back to that.
For sure. And like, just like diet and exercise and health and all these other things, sometimes people know best what they want or their own situation and circumstances. And yet, you know, there's these complicating factors. So you know best your own situation, but then find that person who can help guide you through the decision.
Yeah, I'd like to close with this. I think it was a link that you sent me, Doug, but it was basically a thread of people sharing if they could go back and change anything about their life, what they would have changed. And like, I felt like however many thousands of people that contributed, oh, I would have done this. Oh, I should have done that. Oh, I wish I'd done this. I wish I'd done that. Like, I feel like 50% of the responses were, I wish I opened a Roth IRA when I was young. I wish I contributed. I wish I saved more. I wish I spent less money on dumb things. And so much of kind of looking back in the rearview mirror of our life is we don't regret the things that we did that went poorly. We often regret what we didn't do. And a lot of people are regretting not saving that money. Just something to think about, regardless if you're 16 or 66. This, all the stuff that we're talking about is applicable to all of us in the different formats of our own life.
Another way I've heard that said before is pay yourself first, right? And I think right now, very popular culture idea is kind of the idea of like treat yourself. And I think that's important from time to time too. But I also think it's super important that we pay ourselves. And by that, I mean, we pay our future selves, that we're thinking about what are we going to want 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now? And financially, what can we do today to set ourselves up for when we become that person? Because before you know it, you will be there.
It's so true. Awesome. Anything else that you wanted to drop before we sign off, Doug?
Open a Roth IRA today.
You heard it here. Thank you so much for all the prep work you did to prepare for this episode and for articulating your thoughts. And like I said, the flow chart is on the link. So just click on that and you can refer to what we're talking about. Get yourself going with making some sound financial decisions, regardless of your age and or financial status.
Thanks for having me on, Pete. Really appreciate it. And if anyone wants to reach out, if I could be helpful to them in their individual financial circumstances, I'd be happy to help.
What's the best way to get in touch with you?
Oh, good question. Get in touch with you first.
Okay, perfect. Find me and I'll give you Doug's information. Sick. All right. To all the listeners out there, we so very much appreciate your ears. We thank you for your time. We are incredibly grateful for your attention. On behalf of Mr. Douglas Anton, we are the School and Struggle Podcast. We are out.